Next up, we have Lamina Lay. She's a senior research associate at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, and she's done a variety of research on issues of health, housing, labor force, community development, and wealth creation. She's going to present on African Americans and the subprime lending experience.
Thank you very much. Can everyone hear me? Okay. Thank you very much for asking me to speak on this panel on what I consider to be a very important topic. My visuals this afternoon will be these two briefs, which, if you haven't picked them up, they are out there in the lobby area. As Algernon indicated, I'm going to be talking about African Americans and the subprime lending experience. I'm going to talk about the situation for African Americans in what I call the subprime world and in what I will also call the post-subprime world. I'm going to talk about what some of the impacts have been, why they came about, and what some of the sequelae have been of these impacts. Over the almost year, in case you hadn't noticed, it's almost been about a year since the market took its first nosedive. So I'll start talking about what the impacts have been. And what I'm going to do is give you a couple of numbers that you can just walk away with, you know, sort of buzz numbers that you can keep in mind to help you have a sense of what the impact has been of the subprime mortgage market collapse for African Americans. And those numbers are 53% and 326,000. And I'll explain to you what those numbers are. 53% is the share of all home purchase loans made to African American buyers in 2006. So of all the loans made in 2006 to African Americans who were buying homes, more than half were subprime. And the 326,000, what does that correspond to? That is actually the HMDA data best guesstimate of the total number of loans that the 53% represents. So that, in and of itself, I think, gives you a picture of what the impacts have actually been. Now, what does this mean in terms of place? There are many places around the USA that have had serious problems with subprime loans. There were quite a few in Baltimore, Maryland. There were some in Prince George's County, Maryland, just to keep it local. There were a bunch in Georgia, Ohio, and there were plenty out west, California, Nevada. They didn't necessarily hit African Americans as much there as they did on the East Coast. But in terms of thinking about impacts, you can just keep those two figures in mind, 53% and 326,000 loans. And I mentioned that because that's just a single year, okay? If we assume that many, let's even say half of those loans are likely to be foreclosed on, that's not going to be the whole story in terms of the fallout from subprime lending, because they're the 324,000 subprime loans that were made in 2005, and on and on and on. So the 326,000 just gives you some indicator of what the extent of the problem was. By the year 2006, also, prime lenders had figured out that you could make a lot of money in the subprime market. So you found not only the usual suspects doing business and making loans, but you found some of the more mainstream organizations doing them as well. which is part of what added to the challenge. Also, by 2005 and 2006, some of the more exotic mortgage instruments were becoming normative in terms of what was going on in the subprime market. So there's several reasons why those numbers are as large as they are. Okay, so that sort of gives you a sense of what I think some of the major impacts are. Now, why did these impacts take place? And I was pleased to see that Greg had a theme of music running through his presentation, because I was going to do the same thing. Not quite in the same way, but at least, you know, I'm not going to be the odd man out. What I'm going to say is, to answer the question of why was there such a large impact of subprime lending for African Americans, I'm going to say that what we have is a melody that was played in B flat for many, many years. When the subprime innovations came along, that melody was not shifted to the key of C, which is sort of normative for music, but it was shifted instead to F sharp. Okay? So instead of having this melody that Greg talked about that led to things like neighborhoods that were redlined, didn't have a lot of bank branches in them, were isolated, segregated by race, segregated by income, on the wrong side of the railroad tracks, et cetera, et cetera. That's the way the melody played out previously. And that was what I call the B-flat melody. So now with the subprime situation, we've moved into the F-sharp melody. And that's sort of a shorthand way for my explaining some of the reasons that I think underlie what happened in terms of the subprime lending to African Americans. Historically, both de jure and de facto, we have had separated neighborhoods largely on the basis of race. And these neighborhoods, many of them did not have what I call the mainstream banks and other entities so that people living in them could actually acquire what I will call financial savoir-faire, so they would know how to avoid scams. They would know how to deal with people who were trying to lend them things that weren't good for them. That learning process didn't take place because the institutions were not in those neighborhoods for it to take place. And I would call that just one example of the legacy of racial discrimination and the history of it, of separate but not equal. It was called separate but equal as our national policy for many, many years. Excuse me. And these isolated, segregated, low-income, all of one race kind of neighborhoods were the prime setting for mortgage brokers to go in and set up shop and to offer mortgage products to people who've never had anything positive offered to them. And, you know, they seem like nice guys, and they seem like they were trying to help. And that's how a lot of people got suckered. So I would say that as to why this happened, first part is just a part of the legacy of racial discrimination in this country, and again, the shifting of the melody from being played in B flat to F sharp. A second reason is similar. The legacy of discrimination in this country is not only in the mortgage credit market, but it's also in the real estate market, but it's also in the labor market. And when it's in the labor market, that leads to such things as not being able to get jobs, not being able to get jobs that pay as well as jobs that other people who have less pigment in their skin might be able to get, and not having as much income, not having employment consistently. All of that adds into having a lower credit score. And when it adds into having a lower credit score, what that says to a lender who might even think nicely about you or positively towards you is, oh, you're not eligible for a prime mortgage because your credit history is inconsistent, or it's based on things that are not normative. So It's that kind of discrimination in other areas in the U.S. that has also played into how this subprime situation became as critical as it did for particular groups. And this final reason, okay, the first reason I said was just the basic legacy of discrimination in the housing and the mortgage credit market. Then I would say the legacy of discrimination in other markets played into it as well. But the third piece of it falls out of the first two, but it's slightly different. And Graciela mentioned it in her talk, the huge gap in the home ownership rates. As far as I know, and if anyone in here knows differently, please tell me after the session, the U.S. has only collected home ownership rates since 1940, that you can look at differences by racial ethnic groups. And over the entire period since 1940, there has been at least a 20 percentage point gap between the home ownership rates for African Americans and whites. Presently, that gap is a whopping 28 percentage points. The ownership rate for whites in 2007, 75.2. For African Americans, it was 47.2. And for Latinos, as Graciela pointed out, it was 49.7. So this huge gap in ownership made groups like Latinos and African Americans a likely target for the programs that the federal government was very busy pushing in the latter half of the 1990s. The federal government decided that we're going to have a nation of owners and decided that we were going to boost our home ownership rate up to very high levels. I don't recall what their actual targets were. And the groups who were targeted became targeted in ways that turned out to be dysfunctional for them. And some of that targeting included things such as subprime lending. So I would say there are three major aspects to the why. Two of them are, as I said, the melody that used to be played in B flat that's now being played in F sharp. The same old of racial discrimination and disparate treatment, but just being played out in a slightly different way. The final one, though, I would say, is the role of the federal government and other entities trying to push home ownership, but not caring terribly much about the vehicles that were used to achieve it. So that's enough on my theories about why. And I will move on now just to say a few things about the sequelae since the subprime mortgage market has collapsed almost 1 year ago. And also, I think Graciela mentioned this about the foreclosures of homes. And given the fact that African Americans live in communities that are largely segregated from other people, when you have large numbers of foreclosures, as my 326,000 subprime loans in a year might indicate, when you have large numbers of these homes being foreclosed, there's going to be a spatial aspect of it as well. You aren't going to have one on each block, because that's not the way people live. You're going to have five on a block out of 10 houses. You're going to have that kind of layout of foreclosed properties, and that's a different kind of impact that people can expect to have than if you had them scattered around, one on each block. What happens is we now have it's one of the few times in history where we're going to have a lot of foreclosed properties that are not owned by the federal government necessarily, but they are owned by banks or other financial intermediaries. And these entities classify these properties as REO. It's just real estate owned. It's an item on their books, and they want to get it off as quickly as possible. And they don't really care about the maintenance of it. They don't care so much about the disposition of it, whether it gets rehabbed. They just want the item off their books. What they're going to do is try to sell the foreclosed properties as quickly as possible, and they're going to try to sell them in batches if they can. And when you sell properties quickly and in batches and in a time when housing prices are falling, as they have been, what's going to happen? It's like a fire sale. You're going to force prices to fall even more. What's that going to do? You're talking about neighborhoods that have historically had house prices for the same identical property in an African-American neighborhood. The value is likely to be less than that same identical property across town. So you're talking about neighborhoods that already had house values, even with house prices rising as they did, but they already had prices that were lowered. And when you have a concentration of foreclosed homes and you have this fire sale notion by the owners of these homes, who really, as I said, don't care too much about the disposition, they just want to get them off their books, that poses a spatial neighborhood challenge. One of the other second round or third round effects is, as long as you have foreclosed property standing there, nobody is paying real estate taxes. And when somebody and when people are not paying real estate taxes, local governments don't get as much revenue as they would otherwise. When local governments don't get as much revenue as they would otherwise, guess what happens? The schools don't have as much money as they might, or they don't have money for summer jobs, or they don't have money to open the recreation center, all of which has spillover, second round, third round effects. And that's what we can look forward to, in quotes, around the country as this foreclosure situation sort of works itself out. Now, the issue, that's one of the sequelae. One of the other sequelae that also I think Graciela mentioned was the issue of wealth loss. For all people in the United States of America, an owned home is a huge chunk of their wealth. But for people of color, it's an even huger chunk. And for people of color, it may be the only piece of their wealth portfolio. So when you're losing a home, you're losing not only a place to live, but you're losing a chance to accrue wealth and be able to pass anything on to your children, your grandchildren, et cetera. There are other credit constraints that have come along with this whole issue. It's not just been in the subprime market alone. People have had a harder time getting prime rate mortgages now because everybody's standards are tightened. Everybody's trying to do things by the book. People who have had home equity lines of credit, many of them have had those frozen or terminated because the lender who made the home equity loan or the line of credit realized, okay, house prices are falling. And I gave this person a home equity line of credit based on the value of their property in 2005. It is now 2008, and the property value is a third less than it was three years ago, so I'm not going to keep that credit line with that limit. Those things affect lower income people, people of color, because they're the ones who are taking out the home equity lines of credit to allow themselves to pay necessary bills. The other thing is, okay, so we've had almost a year, and you know the market has collapsed, and what have we tried to do about this on the federal level? Well, there was the FHA Secure program. And at least on the federal level, I mean, there are bills making their way through the House, the Senate, whatever. But the other thing that went into place on the federal level was President Bush's voluntary plan. And I would just mention that there's some issues with that in terms of people of any race being able to get benefit out of that voluntary plan. First of all, the plan will only work if your borrower is still in business. Okay, lots of subprime lenders are out of business, okay? That's the first thing. Second thing, the lender has to decide that he wants to be part of this voluntary plan. And then the third aspect of it that can limit the benefits that anybody can get from this is the fact that the borrower has to be current on their mortgage payments. So if they are behind 30 days or anything like that, they're not going to be able to get any assistance. The FHA Secure program, which they do want to expand and are planning to expand next month, can help you if you have been behind in paying your notes, but it's a little more difficult to get assistance under it if that's your situation, but you can do it. So my point is, there hasn't been a lot in terms of coming forth from the federal government that can deal with the problem of foreclosures for any groups, much less for people of color. So I will end my presentation with just a couple more points. One is just to say I think this is an incredibly complicated issue. As time passes, we're going to see more and more spillovers that we didn't quite think of, but oh yeah, that makes sense. If this isn't in place anymore, well, yeah, down the road, that's not going to be in place either. You know, I mean, we're going to see more and more and more of that. And I would just close by saying, yes, we are now playing in F sharp. We started out playing in B flat. We have yet to get to the key of C. And I don't know if I will live long enough to see this country play in the key of C for everybody, you know, people of color and people of other races as well. Thank you very much.
This is on abusive practices in the subprime mortgage market. And she will talk to us about the effect of race and ethnicity in the subprime mortgage market.
Thank you. Thank you. First of all, thank you so much for inviting us today. This is very exciting to get to talk to you guys today. I'm just going to talk a little bit, primarily about a study that we at the Center for Responsible Lending did a couple of years ago. But before I do that, I'm just going to reiterate a few of the points that Greg and some of the other panelists have made, because I think it's helpful in being good consumers of research on these matters. You see a lot of numbers in the papers, and it's hard to know what to believe and what not to believe because there's a lot of industry spin, and you can often make numbers look the way you want them to look. And so I just want to talk about a couple of things. First of all, the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, which Greg mentioned, was part of a number of pieces of legislation that were passed in the late 60s and 70s to combat the widespread practice of redlining. And the HMDA mandate was very limited when it was first passed. It simply mandated that depository institutions disclose information on their lending at the census tract level. It was very sort of aggregate level disclosure requirements. Having said that, it was a complement to the CRA. It gave some data to actually look at to see whether depository institutions were meeting the credit needs of their communities, but it was limited in nature. As the mortgage market changed over time, and as discriminatory practices changed over time, disclosure requirements under HMDA have changed as well, and the actual data that is publicly available and required by federal law has been expanded greatly. Just a couple of the sort of key changes that have taken place. First of all, the types of financial institutions that are now required to report under HMDA are much broader than the depository institutions that were traditionally required to disclose information. And that's critical because, you know, the mortgage companies and other non-depository institutions now make up a much greater share of the mortgage market than they did back when HMDA was passed in the mid-70s. Secondly, the actual types of information that are required has expanded, and Greg touched on this as well. Lenders have to disclose information at the loan application level, whether a loan has been approved or denied, many demographic factors of the borrower, race, ethnicity, income. And most recently, the most recent change to HMDA required limited information on the price of what are called high-cost loans. I'm not going to get into the technical definition of what these high-cost loans are, but what's critical is this change in HMDA law allowed for the first time researchers and community groups to actually look at discrimination that was occurring at the pricing level, not just at the approval or denial level. And again, sort of as all the panelists have talked about, the nature of discrimination has changed. It's not simply a matter of certain groups not getting loans. It's the terms of these loans that are so often abusive and discriminatory in nature. So when you see statistics in the paper, it's often based on HMDA data because it is the largest publicly available data source on mortgages that includes information on race and ethnicity. The first time that information on price came out with HMDA was with the 2004 HMDA data. And these are just the incidence of high-cost loans by demographic groups. you know, it answered the question pretty quickly about whether African Americans and Latinos were disproportionately receiving higher cost loans. African Americans were receiving high cost loans about 3 times the rate of whites, and Latinos 1.5 to 2 times as much. I mean, these are big differences. So that debate ended when we saw these numbers. They were getting, African Americans and Latinos were getting much more expensive loans. So the next debate was why, and everybody had an answer. Consumer groups saw these numbers and were alarmed and thought that these numbers indicated strong evidence of discriminatory practices in the pricing of mortgages. Industry groups said, hold on a second. You know, you can't just look at these raw numbers and assume that there's discrimination. We don't know anything about the risk characteristics of these different groups. And we know that African Americans and Latinos tend to have lower incomes and lower credit scores. And so we think that you can explain away all of these differences simply by the risk factors posed by these different groups. Now, the problem is HMDA does not have any information on the risk characteristics of borrowers, mainly because industry has fought tooth and nail to keep that information from being disclosed. So they sort of wanted it both ways. We're not going to give you information on the risk of borrowers, but trust us, it's their credit scores and their loan-to-value ratios that are driving these disparities. It's not discrimination. We didn't really want to take their word for it. So in 2004, we had access to a very large proprietary database of subprime loans that included information on credit score, product type, very, very rich database on the terms of mortgages. What it didn't have was racial and ethnic information. So we were able to merge the two databases together and do a study that was very much like the Boston Fed study did, except for the Boston Fed study looked at the approval or denial of loans based on race and ethnicity, and we actually looked at the pricing. So our research question was pretty straightforward. Are African Americans and Latinos more likely to receive higher rate loans than similar, and by similar I mean similar in terms of their risk profiles to white borrowers? For those of you who care, we did a logistical regression on this question, so I'm assuming that most people don't care. And here's just a list of all of the different types of characteristics and loan terms that we were able to control for, so that we were really able to isolate the impact of race and ethnicity on the pricing of these loans. Borrower characteristics, risk characteristics, economic, geographic, time characteristics, really a huge range of variables we controlled for. Lo and behold, we found that there were still unexplained differences that could only be attributed to race and ethnicity, specifically for purchase loans, loans used to purchase properties. African Americans were 15 to 30% more likely to receive high-cost loans. The only category of loans for which that was not true was fixed-rate loans without prepayment penalties, and that's a tiny, tiny part of the subprime market. It's less than 10% of the subprime market. All of the other loans fall into those other categories that you can see up there. And ARM is adjustable rate, FRM is fixed rate, and PP is prepayment penalties. African Americans were also more likely to receive high-cost refinance loans if those loans had prepayment penalties. Again, the vast majority of loans in the subprime market had prepayment penalties. So the fact that loans without prepayment penalties were not statistically significant has more to do with the fact that there are just a few loans in those categories. Interestingly, the pattern is slightly different for Latinos. What we found was that for all categories of purchase loans, Latinos were much more likely to receive high-cost loans than their white counterparts. But we found no evidence of this in the refinance market. And Graciela may have an explanation for this. Our director of Latino Affairs thinks it may be due to the fact that the vast majority of Latino purchasers are new immigrants or first generation and maybe the less sophisticated. And after a legacy of discrimination in which they've been turned down for loans, may be unlikely to refinance once they actually have a loan. And so those Latinos who are actually refinancing may be the more sophisticated, more savvy shoppers. Just a theory. We don't really have any proof for it. So the bottom line is that controlling for every conceivable risk factor that can legitimately be used to price loans, African Americans and Latinos are more likely to get high-rate loans. You know, again, it's it's hard to know exactly what's going on. We think that's probably a combination of factors. There are probably a lot of instances of loan officers and brokers treating blacks, Latinos, and whites differently, but to give higher rates to certain people. There's also probably a great deal of market segmentation, and these are sort of the structural issues that Greg talked about, where high-cost lenders and brokers are disproportionately serving African-American and Latino borrowers, while the lower-cost lenders are underserving these communities. That's sort of the, you have a disparate impact, if not intentionally discriminatory. So I just want a couple of final points. There are sort of two issues moving forward that we like to think about. The first is, how do we help current borrowers who are facing foreclosure? And the second is, how do we prevent a similar crisis from occurring in the future? As Wilhelmina pointed out, most of the federal efforts that are underway to help current victims are insufficient. Is that fair? Okay. Hope Now, which is the voluntary program that the administration has set up that allows loan services to voluntarily modify people's loans, is not making a dent in the problem. We think really the best way to help people who are currently facing foreclosure is through bankruptcy reform. And this is sort of a technical point, but if you file for bankruptcy, a bankruptcy judge can modify your credit card loans, the loans on a vacation home, the loans on your boat, the loans on your car, the loans on your investment property, but not the loans on your primary residence. It's a crazy, crazy loophole in bankruptcy law that needs to be closed. And we estimate that about 600,000 subprime borrowers could be saved if that loophole was closed and judges were actually able to modify loans of people who have been victimized. So that's sort of the first part, which is, how do we help the current victims? The second part is, how do we prevent discriminatory practices going forwards? The first, and we think most important, is to ban discretionary pricing. Right now, loan officers, brokers can pretty much charge anybody whatever they want. You don't have to get offered the best rate that you qualify for. And having that discretion just lends itself to discriminatory practices, whether implicit, explicit, intentional, or unintentional. Second, you know, we as researchers, we're always, you know, concerned about the lack of good data, and HMDA, as beneficial as it is still lacking in many pieces of information that would be valuable. And we were able to do the study that we had, that we did, because at the time we had this other data source, but it's not publicly available and it's very expensive and we don't have it anymore. So there's no good reason why this data, the information on risk, should not be publicly available, so that everybody, every community, can actually look at lenders in their area and see whether they are treating equally qualified borrowers equally. And then the rest, you know, greater enforcement of fair lending, greater resources devoted to fair lending. That's it. Thank you. Thank you.